I thought I'd start by pointing out how much I appreciate this this poster of the fields. It's multiply iconic, multiply indexical, and multiply symbolic, and it shows old-fashioned technology, you know, writing on the board. I'm not using PowerPointless. Although I do have an overhead projector, which I'll use for a few things. I don't usually read papers, but because this is being recorded, I think I'd better stick a little bit to a script. One thing I've inserted at the beginning is, this is just for future reference. Something from Science News in January 29 of this year. A person, strategic director Conrad Wolfram of Wolfram Research, in his TED Global 2010 talk, Teaching Kids Real Math with Computers, his scientific observations. We've got a real problem with math education right now. Basically, no one's very happy. Those learning it think it's disconnected, uninteresting, and hard. Those trying to employ the people, I guess, think they don't know enough. I think the answer is staring us right in the face. Use computers. I believe that correctly using computers is the silver bullet for making math education work. In the real world, math isn't necessarily done by mathematicians. It's done by geologists, engineers, biologists, all sorts of different people, modeling and simulation. It's actually very popular, but in education, it looks very different. Dumbed down problems, lots of calculating. I estimate that just today across the world, we spend about 106 average world lifetimes teaching people how to calculate by hand, and they don't even have the fun of doing it. Well, obviously, this I'm not using this as an example of the direction I'm going to be going here, and I really wonder how he got this estimate of 106 average world lifetimes teaching people how to calculate just today across the world. A lot of questions. I will start with an annotated abstract in case you forgot that I wrote one. I had when I wrote the paper, so I thought it would be a good idea to go back. Qualification of quantification across the curriculum. And having enjoyed the first two papers this morning, I thought maybe it should have a subtitle turning some of their titles around. I thought of immaterial and disembodied autoethnography. Leaning on Paul Halma's confessional automathography. Now, there is a mind that took some risks and backed it up with further exploration. At least in the social and behavioral sciences, so delineated respecting the preference from psychology. Psychology doesn't want to be known as a social science. It is a behavioral science, even today. Practitioners and students alike have subscribed to another distinction, that between qualification and quantification. In fact, one might easily get the impression that the latter distinction amounts to a debate, if not outright warfare. Here, a small aside about air quotes. Air quotes have not been linguistically documented because they're in the air. And I've tried to think for some decades, how could a student go about studying air quotes? Because quite often, TV might be a source, but that's not a very naturalistic source. And I believe they erupted while I was in the field in the 70s. I don't remember any dialects, and there are dialects of air quotes. There are air quotes, and their air quotes and their air quotes and their air and their all kinds of dialects of air quotes. We have incorporated that in our most postmodern idioms, I think, to show the hedge factor that we feel about most everything in postmodernity. So I can't help but insert some air quotes here. Not too many, I hope. Students arrive to their disciplines largely ignorant of the semiotic underpinnings of their own intellectual experiences from birth onwards, and of the semiotic foundations for their elected fields of study through their developmental histories. In addition, typically without a broad background in the history and philosophy of the disciplines, students fail to perceive how all of them interlock in a myriad of ways. Being so undisciplined about their disciplines, it's not surprising how students can be so easily recruited to the debate between qualification and quantification. The majority of students and their mentors subscribe to a contrast between qualification and quantification, and usually in so doing they privilege the latter, assuming it to be the more scientific approach for meaning making. A subset deflect to the default position of subscribing to mixed methods. At the same time, the condition of relatively innumeracy of young and old within and beyond any but the most technical fields has been conceded without a struggle. As a consequence, an unhealthy hierarchy is fractured by feelings of inadequacy and or resentment. Perhaps with greater engagement in public education in the future, affording younger students trickling up through the ranks a more inquiring interest in the qualia and quanta across the cultural curricula, higher education may enjoy a new lease on intellectual work and play. I think play is the operative word. Meanwhile, the position taken in this paper asserts that both qualification and quantification are cultural practices, and further that ethic, drawing on Kenneth Pike, quantification is predicated on prior emic qualification. The cultural may be at the social level, may at the social level include the linguistic, and at the individual level include both bodily and cognitive processes. At the same time, higher education may be able to benefit from considering approaches aimed at younger audiences. These include the so-called Singapore method, the private eye approach, looking and thinking by analogy using a magnifying loop. The foregrounding of abduction, larding the more recognized induction and deduction processes, and building on awareness through movement. I can't help but note that a person mentioned this morning was Maxine Sheets Johnstone. Before she was a scholar that we recognize from philosophy and going into all these ancillary fields, she was a dancer, so she knew her body. The underlying justification for my inclusion in this workshop may remain obscure, no matter how I might try to justify it, even or especially to myself. I identify myself as a semiotician, first of all, because semiotics is more inclusive, and dare I say more exclusive, than being an anthropologist. In their fashions, neither enterprise will boil down to a discipline, nor behave in a disciplined manner. Semiotics has been termed an approach, a metadiscipline, and even, unfortunately in my opinion, a doctrine. Anthropology draws on any number of other more conventional and circumscribed disciplines without resorting to calling itself either an interdiscipline or a metadiscipline. Anthropology spreads out to consider everything from art to zoology. Its four North American subdisciplines centering on socioculture, linguistics, biology, and history and prehistory. A more recently labeled fifth subdiscipline is actually orthogonal to those other four. This other fifth discipline has been variously called applied anthropology, advocacy anthropology, activist anthropology, and sometimes participation action research, and that field cross-cuts any number of still other fields. Well, anthropology may help us understand some social problems, it is neither necessary nor sufficient in countering them. Social problems don't demand rocket science, especially when not even rocket science is rocket science. Anthropology, at least in North America, consists in the infinite enterprise of understanding our own species, Homo sapiens, through all time and across all space, relying only on our own faculties and some scanty traces left behind by previous conspecifics. Back to my auto non-mathography. Then, among my identities beyond semiotics and anthropology, I will tack on linguistics. In a way, language abuts mathematics, but a mathematician I'm not. At base, both language and mathematics can be taken as deep formal structures that gain content as they are entrained by disciplines of substance. That must be why the Fields Institute is of the mathematical sciences, because I'm not sure that we can call mathematics per se a science. It's when it inhales from other disciplines of substance. Well, although I'm not a mathematician, I confess to have supported myself for more than a dozen years in the 1950s and 60s as an actuary, and letting that gainful employment feed my incipiently anthropological global travel. Once capitulating to anthropology, academically retread and re-employed, I also collaborated in the production of an edited volume, which you have seen projected, in 2003, titled Educational Perspectives on Mathematics as Semiosis, From Thinking to Interpreting to Knowing, published by Lagos Press in Ottawa, and that was Anderson, Sense, Ludlow, Zellweger, and Cifarelli. Although I've not studied mathematics since diverting to semiotics, anthropology, and linguistics, I have used, abused, and pondered mathematics. Like everyone, I have been influenced by mathematics and also by particular mathematicians. I will mention one of my favorite mathematical philosophers, I already have, Paul Hamos, 1916 to 2006. He coined the term automathography for his own autobiography, How I Became a Mathematician, 1985, and that has liberated me to incorporate some autoethnography in this piece. Throughout Hamos's life, and especially in his latter life, he shared his thoughts about thinking, speaking, writing, and reading mathematics for everyone. Many eminent scholars come to a tipping point in their maturity when they find it natural to confess, to reflect, to interpret, to share, to speak in allegory. I find nowhere where Hamos focused on hearing mathematics or listening to mathematics, but the oversight is surely mine. I also think that not only do mature scholars have a lot to share when they are released from the production line, as it were, but people of any age, if they go back and unpack what they have in their own mental reflections of growing up, not the best database, of course, but there are many, many insights that are back there in all of our memories, whether they're contaminated or not. Hamos's advice about writing mathematics rather parallels Gricean conversational maxims. Hamos wrote, "The basic problem in writing mathematics is the same as in writing biology, writing a novel, writing directions for assembling a harpsichord. The problem is to communicate an idea, to do so and to do it clearly. You must have something to say, have someone to say it to, organize what you want to say, arrange it in the order, write it, rewrite it, rewrite it several times, be willing to think hard about and work hard on mechanical details such as diction, notation, and punctuation. That's all there is to it. I would myself add an exclamation point. Halmos, by the way, along with Thomas Sebeok, semiotician, 1920 to 2001, belonged to the infamous Hungarian Mafia at Indiana University. There were many parallels in their lives, being born about 4 years apart in Hungary and both arriving to the United States while relatively young. Sebeok happened to be, like myself, semiotician, anthropologist, linguist. To my amazement, Sebeok also briefly worked on the Sami language in Lapland, 30 years before my initiation to that language and culture. As an aside, my first stint of field work in Lapland periodically confronted the challenges of no roads, no electricity, occasional temperatures of 40 degrees below zero in either Celsius or Fahrenheit, and for 5 years. Halmos and Grice would have me trim my thoughts while letting them resuscitate up, reconstitute, as it were, their very substance in the process of boiling them down, and then to attend to relevance and digestibility. I think that is a cognitive, ubiquitous cognitive process that we are all the time reducing and reconstituting, reducing and reconstituting. I chose the title of qualification of quantification primarily because I resist the pernicious assumptions that any debate should be indulged on that turf, especially with the overdetermined premises that our culture feeds us. We overhear in many disciplines that there is a qualification-quantification debate. To be contrary, I suggest that quantification rests on prior qualification, whether the latter process is conscious or not. As a subtext, I also hold no truck with C.P. Snow's two cultures, that assertion being the major justification for the position paper I wrote with John Dealey, Martin Crompton, Joseph Ransdell, Thomas Sebeok, and Turi von Uexküll, published in Semiotica in 1984. That was called A Semiotic Perspective on the Sciences, Steps Toward a New Paradigm. Well, I launched this talk by throwing back a gauntlet to Mr. whatever his name was. Regarding Snow's two culture, I refuse to throw in the towel and acquiesce to two cultures. It's clearly the case that I've never subscribed to popular notions about mathematics being somehow demanding, difficult, or discriminating against classes of people, or children, or genders. It did not surprise me, upon an introduction to anthropology, that there's no one mathematics, no generic homogenizing human culture, no common linguistic cultures, structures organizing the cosmos, and perhaps no overwhelmingly molar species-level cognitive blueprint for experiencing the world. Individually and collectively, we are akin to fish floating about and only occasionally swimming in a transparent medium that itself is also an internalized and even individualized outrigger. As scholars, we probe the marginally unmarked transparencies on the edges of our senses, seeking some resolution in translucency before those translucencies themselves shapeshift to become opacities. The perception that feeds our finite senses is profoundly shaped by our prior ontogenetic and phylogenetic histories before any input becomes accessible to what we term cognition. Cognition receives these slivers and shards of input, rejecting some and accepting others while elaborating those found acceptable. The pulse of reduction and expansion is as common to research in any discipline as it is to the dance of sensation, perception, cognition itself. For myself, growing up within the far western states of the United States, I attended more than a dozen quite distinct public school systems, where I witnessed a variety of habits, or perhaps they were already called methods, of getting subject matters across to young minds. Whatever the methods, I suspect most young minds would agree with me that mathematics, at least starting with arithmetic, seem quite straightforward, even easy. Arithmetic afforded the luxury of answers, of closure, of intrinsic reward. I do believe that young minds are already linguists, ethnographers, philosophers, semioticians, and maybe mathematicians. Later, as a student, I had to acknowledge other top-down pedagogies, or more frankly, biases, that could enter the picture to discriminate the relations between teachers and learners, between learners and learners, and between teachers and teachers. These culture-saturated factors may then act to create evaluative hierarchies among and between all teachers and learners. This thread will come up later. I used to remember and can still practice trance brought on as I could when I was, let's say, 4 or 5 or 6, by, in fact, pondering word and thing, alphabet, letter, and sound, ideograph, and number sense. Children are born philosophers, and they're probing the very factors that we find interesting as older people when we think it's a research issue. It's a bodily and mental process that we have access to throughout our lives, and if we choose to research it, we can, but it is not something so alien to our experience. Another thread to braid in later concerns the native and naive capacities that motivate young minds in the direction of language and mathematics, saturated as they are in the culture of that time and place. Even some other creatures besides humans appear to be on a similar ontogenetic slope, making erudite inferences with little evidence and at young ages. With all these faculties aligned in our favor, it's a puzzle why many persons at many ages assert that they are not good at math or that math is hard. Just as puzzling is that some of these same persons have the same impression of linguistics, often knowing little about that discipline, and I suppose they know little about math as well. Still another thread, a caveat perhaps, will admit to impediments in the natural emergence of linguistic and mathematical processing in the young. That impediment refers back to culture and society. Deeper structure culture and surface structure society. The distinction between culture and society, like the distinction between deep structure language and its manifestations at the surface level in speech, sign, writing, and such, is that only the more surface phenomena of society and speech behavior are empirically accessible, although we are entranced, I should say enthralled, by the new tool toys that make pictures of supposedly localized cognitive processes. We study society and speech, the empirically accessible, not primarily because we are interested in society and speech, but because we are vitally compelled to get a better understanding of the deeper structures of culture, language, and cognition. So, this caveat points to the unique roadblocks, the mind blocks, that both the deeper culture and the enveloping society have inadvertently set up to compromise the natural development of young and old alike. We blame the public schools. But all schools receive damaged goods. Students who were challenged throughout their lives by poor nutrition, inadequate supervision, and lack of intellectual engagement. This sorry state of affairs can be traced back before birth for some children who are born already compromised by factors not genetic at all. In the U.S., the attitude has been that money and or clever methods can trump the various disadvantages that encumber many students, rather than aiming to correct the inexcusable underlying factors. I've let myself be liberated by Halmos's auto-methography, so back to my own auto-ethnography. In grammar school, the more historical realms of the humanities really overwhelmed me. So much content seemed arbitrary, names and places and dates to memorize. There was no content, no systemic substrate in sight. The likewise historical, murky social studies also intimidated me, but for different reasons. Here there were names and places and dates and explanations to memorize. Instead of being arbitrarily descriptive, as in history, for all practical purposes neutral, the social studies up the ante in expecting one to believe the expectations, making the student complicit in ratifying the entire project of the social studies. That came closer to religion, and I am still suspicious of the social and behavioral sciences where I reluctantly reside, given the scarcity of departments of semiotics. However, memorization itself was not a hurdle and should not be for anyone. Memorization is as simple as muscle building, almost mindless, taking only discipline. Admittedly, discipline is one of the compromise factors in educational settings. In pedagogical philosophies, memorization comes into and out of popularity. The rewards of rote learning, let's say of literary pieces, or why not multiplication tables, can be substantial in terms of quality of experience and long-term in quantity of utility. But like most addictive practices, memorization should be indulged in moderation, as it can suck away critical thinking processes. Now, it's the case that the so-called sciences and even mathematics are historical disciplines, but that's not how they are presented to students. For better and for worse, rather, science education relies on the description of processes, processes often reduced to some subset of empirical practices that involve manipulation, that is, body and mind. Then the language arts enter to facilitate the digestion and communication of those selected processes. The result is not belief so much as trust, perhaps because of the medley of senses enrolled in the often arbitrary experimental exercises. Another of my favorite mathematical inspirations, Harry Pollard, (1919–1985), belonging to my evidently favorite older generation, along with Paul Halmos and Thomas Sebeok, has said, if not written, that mathematics and the sciences, to contrast form with substance, could better be taught through cameos. Why not unpack the insight of a historical figure, say Franklin or Archimedes, in a brief demonstration, rather than domesticate uniformed and uniform young minds by forcing them through premeditated steps in a lab manual, with only correct results that count. Around 1980, Harry Pollard, whom I knew because of the Purdue connection, also described with dismay student dormitories as residential discotheques, undermining any educational potential and bringing young minds together. I can only imagine that today these same residential halls devoted to gaming and gossip might be similarly critiqued. Early mathematics education not infrequently also draws on the language arts. Languaging is prominent, at least in story problems and in linear, often temporally syntagmatic thinking as found in algebra. Early mathematics education also draws on art itself, as in diagrammatic, often spatially paradigmatic thinking, as exemplified in geometry. I take mathematics itself to play a deeper, formal, substantive role, like language itself, to any surface applications that plug in the content or subject matters of other disciplines. Mathematics and language together undergird counting, measuring, weighing, calculating, mathematizing, speaking, signing, writing, and drawing. And by the way, I think relations themselves are more important than anything digitalized as in counting or something like that. We're really talking about understanding relations among many things. The deeper structures closer to primary modeling systems following CBOC enable and limit the more surface structures. The corollary is that only the surface structures are amenable to interrogation. Back to my assertion of the straightforward place and pace of the formal fields of mathematics and language in early human experience, I remind myself that mathematicians may peak early in their lives, or at least make noteworthy contributions at an early age. Historians and philosophers approach retirement before they're out of intellectual diapers, and social scientists slot somewhere in between. Thanks to the new Google-sponsored Culturology database, I noticed that actors also peak early. I know that Halmos could make something of this conjunction of mathematics and actors, as he also saw mathematics as a creative art. The often hermetically sealed disciplines of psychology, philosophy, and sociology, and the amalgams of semiotics and anthropology, join mathematicians to make sense of mathematizing from a cognitive point of view. No view can be deterministic or indelible. Ever present, the deep structures of culture, language, and biology are likewise integral, but not deterministic. We editors of the book that was shown earlier, Educational Perspectives on Mathematics of Semiosis, referred to the Mathematics Semiotics Education Trivium. Educational activity is developmentally constrained, socially situated, culturally shaped, and linguistically and visually mediated. The co-authored preface in this 2003 volume, The Art, Craft, and Science of Mathematical Meaning-Making, we go beyond Halmos's exploration of how to do things with mathematics. We foreground all of the following in all their possible permutations: thinking and writing, speaking and listening, reading and interpreting. All together, they triangulate with what we infer from the outside and what we enjoy from the inside. Enjoy being the operative word. The three R's of education, reading, writing, and arithmetic, correspond to a surface survey of our concerns in educational settings and in negotiating other worlds. These competences, under the rubrics of literacy and numeracy, rest on deeper structures already mentioned: cultural, linguistic, psychological, biological, and some matrix dubbed the cognitive. Sometimes the concentration on surface competencies, or better, performativities, of the three R's precludes any acknowledgement of deeper competencies. The use of competence here has been flavored by Chomsky's distinction of competence and performance, and by Saussure's distinctions of la langue and la parole. Chomsky, as a linguistic theorist, has devoted himself to competence, competence taken to be deep potentiating factors enabling a realization at the empirical surface structure in performance, in parole, as it were. What I am suggesting with respect to teaching learning situation is that without more explicit bodily and mindful engagement, the surface performance in math or language may be untouched by the rewards of some awareness of competence. Fluency in numeracy and literacy practices rests on integral experience, however we label it using the English labels of mind, brain, mind, and body. There's a vast literature in innumerable disciplines approaching the unities and distinctions of body, brain, mind, and cognition itself. I have mentioned discipline in several senses, from rote learning to contextually nuanced behavior. While stumbling along the teaching-learning path, we are introduced to sporadic treats of exaltation, of feeling high, of being in the zone. This notion more often refers to athletes on a lucky streak. Or is it luck? And does it really matter? What matters is that we allow ourselves and others the experience, even if tinged with addiction. Being in the zone should not be a luxury for sports figures, but a reward to all practitioners, to all actors, and perhaps to all thinkers. Although with passive amusement, there are few constraints other than bodily needs preventing self-indulgence. Pedagogies often privilege the examinable surface practices where there's little elasticity between surface inputs and surface outputs. Crude rote memorizing would be an example. Much more engaging to consider in any field whatever will be the dynamics of open-ended give-and-take conversation between teachers and learning, and between learners, and the internal speech, or perhaps thought, of both teachers and learners. The bottom line for me is that outcomes are overdeterminedly superficial in cases where a teacher is not a learner as well. Educators slip into the flow of teaching, learning, somewhere between thinking and interpreting, between word and thing, between language and diagrams, between description and explanation, between individuality and community, and between convention and contingency. Were teaching, learning tame and linear, mastery would be the target, and only suspense would intervene between the knowledge taught and the understanding received or constructed. Instead, teaching learning proceeds along kinky and recursive paths, strewn with surprise. Certain conditions contribute to these happy outcomes: a twist of redundancy, an invitation to creativity, and a license to explore beyond induction and deduction into the open territory of abduction and hypothesis. Now to across the curriculum. Because of the ambitious breadth of anthropology, I will return to the intersections of mathematics and semiotics in this discipline, a proxy for the curriculum in my original title. Most departments of anthropology in North America distinguish qualitative methodology from quantitative methodology in separate courses, at least for graduate programs and sometimes in undergraduate programs as well. This bifurcation reifies the pernicious distinction between qualification and quantification that's already lurking in the mental models of most people in this culture. Of course, quantitative methodology has a macho ring, suggesting a prescriptive imperative to collect quantizable data and then to reduce them to their underlying logics, perhaps via statistics. Sometimes the quantitative course is the only one of the two courses that is mandatory. Qualitative methodology sounds mushier, doubtlessly easier, and an afterthought. Sometimes the particular qualitative methodology that's foregrounded is that of ethnography, that being the study of some group of humans, or sometimes of individuals, or sometimes of non-humans, in a naturalistic setting. The ethnographer, although never invisible, hangs out for a longer or shorter time in that setting, observing and participating, eating and drinking, making friends and enemies, and sometimes hopefully becoming linguistically competent enough to talk, first answering questions and later perhaps asking some. Although ethnographic participant observation may be the type specimen of qualitative inquiry in anthropology, participant observation applies mostly to sociocultural research, although not all of that. It applies somewhat to linguistic research, only occasionally to biological research in primate ethology and ecology, for example, and virtually never in archaeology. Yet those other anthropological subdisciplines and all other disciplines rely on qualitative inquiry to probe their subject matters. Inspired by the distinctions made in mathematics, I've whimsically suggested that our quantitative methodology course be termed discrete anthropology, and that our qualitative methodology then be dubbed indiscrete anthropology. Be that as it may, methodology in either case must not be reduced to methods, to techniques, or to software programs. Clearly, both qualitative and quantitative issues pertain to any and all of the subdisciplines in anthropology. I have made an effort to erase, or at least to nuance, the distinction between qualification and quantification when I teach the only of the two courses I am qualified to teach, that of qualitative inquiry. The first assignment consists in an unproblematized autobiography that may be conventional and linear, that is, syntagmatic. On its heels follows another ungraded assignment, but prescriptively nonlinear and paradigmatic. Why not call it a more revelatory and reflective autoethnography slice of experience? I think Halmos would understand. Then, without pausing to reflect on how to participate in participant observation, which would leap ahead to presume the use of language in either or both of the modes of competence and performance, we observe. We observe, musing about the hints of paradigmatic joints that may parse the syntagmatic flow of some behavior. Later, language may confirm or contest those hypotheses. We observe, drawing and diagramming objects in space, movement in space and time, respecting the challenges in dealing with all that's unfamiliar. We observe, eyeballing the sizes and shapes and weights of any things in our significant surrounds. We observe, trying our minds at estimating anything with a provisional unit of analysis. Perhaps we assume individuals to be such a unit, although this is obviously our cultural assumption that you can count heads. Then, roughly, how many are here and there and now and then? We observe, coming down to wondering, what is the Umwelt within which we operate once we cross to the other side of any lingua-cultural divide? Qualification of quantification, moving towards the end. Major premises. Qualification and quantification are supposedly complementary, if not contradictory, approaches to data documentation. Okay. The relationship of a phenomenon to its abstract, qualified, and/or quantified representation as data is always a variable of the nature of the phenomenon, of the context, of the researcher, and maybe whether or not the researcher ate breakfast, and of the purposes to which the data are addressed. Data can never be commensurable to the subject matter, let alone be exhaustive of it. Nor will the subject reduce satisfactorily to data, let alone be determined by them. Korzybski, the map is not the territory. A phenomenon is amenable to both qualification and quantification by virtue of perceived continuous analogic differences and or discrete digital discontinuities of some content, matter, energy, information in space and time, remembering that the present contains the past. Observational categories for quantification of units and their relationships are no less subject nor less rigorous than those for quantification. somehow I thought Goethe's scaffolding is not the building would fit here. Certain phenomena can best be represented through quantification, particularly behavior involving established cultural equivalences and correlations, uncontested counted entities, and measured aggregations. However, it is incumbent upon the investigator to realize that all quantification is predicated upon preliminary qualification. The whole is greater than and different from the sum of its parts. People always quote the whole is greater than, but they forget that middle part. It's different from, different not in degree, it's different in kind from the sum of its parts, the parts themselves being never unproblematic. Also often forgotten is the premise that the whole is also simpler than its parts. Those lead up to inductive caveats. Phenomena may not be adequately represented as data. Data may not constitute description. Description may not lead to generalization. Generalization may not constitute analysis. Analysis may not facilitate synthesis. Synthesis may not contribute toward theory. Theory may not facilitate universals. Universals may not be meaningful at the scale of either phenomena or data. Finally, data themselves are always shaped by theory in the first place, whether deliberately or inadvertently, by virtue of the tool toys of language and culture. Deductive caveats. Wholes have integrity. Integrity won't parse. Most importantly, data insults the subject matter, but we still need it. Finally, abductive dialectics. Abduction, deduction, and induction do synergize. Incompleteness, inconsistency, and indeterminacy reflect an interesting world. And here is where I can bring in Chomsky again, that data are not the subject matter. Thank you.